This week on The Score, how did the Republicans and Democrats come to dominate American politics? Who are the heroes of progress? And what is the stuff of progress? What explains the conflict between Kurds and Turks? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Today's show looks at American politics, global economic history, and foreign affairs. We examine the political party system, human progress, and the conflict in the Middle East between Turks and Kurds. First, let's talk about the American political parties. Michael Barone hangs his hat at the American Enterprise Institute, but as a journalist and pundit, he is a longtime observer of the U.S. political system. He has a new book coming out that chronicles the history of the two parties that dominate American politics. I spoke to him by telephone from his office in Washington on Thursday afternoon. We're talking today to Michael Barone, who's the author of a new book on the American political party system. Michael, what's the title of your book?
How America's Political Parties Have Changed and How They Don't. And it's inspired by a professional lifetime of observing, participating, and commenting on politics, partisan elections, and I'm inspired by the talk that people think that we're in an apocalyptic time, everything is going to change. In fact, one of the things they don't really appreciate is that we have these very old political parties. They've been around for a long time, and I think there are some fundamental reasons why they have persisted and are likely to persist into the future.
So the American political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have been able to adapt to changing times and changing conditions. Is that the basic thesis of your book?
Well, that's one basic thesis. They certainly have. I mean, the Democratic Party was formed in 1832 to reelect Andrew Jackson and deny recharter of the Second Bank of the United States. They were successful on both counts. By the end of the 1830s, they're still around. The Republican Party was formed in 1854 to oppose slavery in the territories and to seek repeal of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And in fact, not only was slavery in the territories prevented, but slavery was abolished 11 years after the creation of the Republican Party by constitutional amendment. So those parties had their early successes. They've changed on some issues, trade issues. The Republicans were originally the tariff party. The Democrats were for free trade. By the 1970s, that's reversed. It may be in the process of being reversed again. But each of them also has, I think, has retained the same basic character, personality, DNA of the party that has made them competitors and made them capable of winning votes in what has always been a diverse society.
What is the factor that makes the United States have two major political parties as opposed to three or four or five? Why do we have the Democrats and Republicans and no other political party that gains seats in Congress, wins the White House?
You're echoing the 1905 book by the German sociologist Werner Schombach, Why Is There No Socialism in America? Why have the Republicans and Democrats persisted? I think the reason is that in a culturally diverse country, each provides a means for which people can seek political expression. The Republican Party has always been centered around a core constituency of people widely considered to be typical Americans, but who are not by themselves a majority. The Democratic Party has always been a coalition of outgroups of people who are perceived as not being typical Americans, but who taken together can be a majority. They've had problems holding all those groups together. They have internal disputes, just as the Republicans have had problems expanding from their core constituency. But both parties have succeeded, and both parties have rebounded from political disasters and have come back to become competitive again.
And American voters seem to like divided government. They'll elect Republicans to the presidency, but have a Democratic Congress or you know, Democratic House, Republican Senate. What explains that?
Well, I think it's partly just because we're in a period where there's very close competition between the parties. So it means that if the Republicans win the presidency by a small margin, the Democrats might win the House of Representatives or hold the Senate by a small margin. That's been the history of recent times. We were a party of divided government in the period 1874 to 1894. We've been a party of divided government largely since 1968. But the period in between that, 1894, 1968, we tended to have one party having the presidency, the Senate, and the House of Representatives at the same time or the other. And so the parties, sometimes you get people, one party having, winning enough elections to maintain control, over a period of time. But those periods of time have never really gone past about 12 or 14 years. And so there's continuing competition by these two parties that are vehicles for the political expression of a diverse voting population.
And the pendulum seems to swing more often today than it did in the 1950s, 60s. We had 40 years of the Democrats in control of Congress prior to 1994, but the control of Congress has gone back and forth several times in the 25 years since then. Is that more like the norm for American politics, or are we in an unusual situation of instability?
It's one norm for American politics. Really, this is, you know, the fact that the Democrats held majorities in the House of Representatives for 40 consecutive years was unusual. But I can remember at the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, the political scientists, political journalists were having theories about why the Republicans would always have the advantage in presidential elections. And they'd won five of the six elections between 1968 and 88 by average popular vote percentage of 10%, big margins. And why Democrats would always have an advantage in Congress, especially in the House of Representatives. And they had these abstract theories that explained the recent past. They didn't explain the future. Bill Clinton broke the Republican lock on the presidency in 1992, and starting in that election, Democrats have won the presidency more often than the Republicans. They both won on occasion, but Democrats have won more often, and an average popular vote margin of about 2%. In 1994, in the leadership of Newt Gingrich, the Republicans won the election for House of Representatives. And they have won, I think starting with that election, 10 of the next 13 elections, they've won majorities in the House of Representatives. So the parties that supposedly, according to political scientists, were not capable of winning the presidency, and the other party that wasn't capable of winning the House, since those predictions were made, that party has actually prevailed in most presidential elections and prevailed in most congressional elections.
Are the political parties weaker today than they were earlier? And I'm thinking particularly in terms of what's happened since the campaign finance reform laws in the post-Watergate era that sort of separated parties from their candidates, made candidates more independent of parties in terms of raising funds for their elections or re-elections. Am I misperceiving that?
Well, I think, if you go back in time, say before up to the early 1960s, you still had, patronage politics. You still had a period when Democrats usually, but sometimes Republicans, had big city machines, and they would assess the state employees, and they'd have money. And before the early 20th century, we had primary elections. The party insiders, typically a small group of people really running the show, which select the candidates and so forth. The parties today obviously are weaker in that regard, and we have this kind of weird presidential nominating process that gets reformed every cycle or two and still is obviously not entirely satisfactory. But one of the fascinating things is that the mood of voters, who often did ticket splitting in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, have become much more straight party voters. The large majority of voters either vote for all the Republicans or for all the Democrats, and they don't split their tickets. We were told some years ago ticket splitting was the modern way. Well, it's not the modern way that's prevailing right now in American politics. And I've got a chapter in my book about how America's political parties change, where I explain how the liberal Republicans, who were a force in the party up through the 1960s, have largely disappeared, and how the conservative Democrats, voters and politicians, have largely disappeared. And I think, the historical trends that gave us liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats happened a long time ago and ceased to be reflect existing conditions. And so those voters have sorted themselves out so that we have, as what the political scientist of the 1950s called for, one clearly liberal party, one clearly conservative party. Today the political scientists complain about that, so here we are.
That leads to my last question. We're talking to Michael Barone of the American Enterprise Institute about his new book on the American political party system. How do political parties fit into the formulation of public policy? Are they filters for public policy? Are they originators of it? Or do they just go with the flow, whatever their candidates want to talk about?
Well, I think the political parties as they operate today sometimes are a forum for debate, discussion, formulation of foreign policy, but they're also really it's the candidates and the people who are elected to office who become important, and they're the ones that really set public policy apart. And we had a period when we had divided, seemingly permanently divided, government between Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses, where there were a lot of bipartisan compromises. That's less common today now that we have more ideological parties, and now that the parties are roughly evenly matched. So both Democrats and Republicans, looking ahead, for example, to the 2020 election, have some reason to think, gee, our party could take it all. We could take the presidency, the Senate, the House, and then we could do everything our way. So why should we compromise now with the other party when we got a chance for everything? Well, that doesn't happen. One party doesn't get everything very often, but both parties and politicians who are temperamentally optimistic anticipate that there's some possibility of that, and they're looking forward to it.
My last question is, which drives the success of political parties more, policy or personality?
I think the answer is policy and perceived success or failure of policy. Both the Republican Party in 1932 suffered, and the Democratic Party in 1920 suffered disastrous defeats as a result of voters' perceptions that they had stood for public policies that had disastrous results. They both managed to recover and become competitive again within a decade, but it really comes down to results, or let us say perceived results.
Well, Michael Barone, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your time today, and good luck with the new book.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on your program. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
When it comes to economic news, headlines prefer a pessimistic tone. Unemployment, recession, and dispossession make news while new jobs, expansion, and innovation sit below the surface. Chelsea Follett is managing editor at humanprogress.org, which tries to present the upside of the news about economics. In this conversation at the Cato Institute last Wednesday, she is cheery and enthusiastic about human progress.
Humanprogress.org is a data website with over 1,000 data sets showing all of the ways that free markets are making our lives better. People like you and me value freedom for its own sake, but for most people, that's not enough. Showing them the connection between freedom and declining rates of poverty, rising prosperity, rising literacy, a better food supply, better education, all of these things, that's a much better argument for progress. And in addition to data, we also have news stories highlighting the latest developments in technology and medicine that are improving human well-being. We have original written content that put the data into context and that comment on current events. And we also have curated data highlights for those people who are not interested in creating their own visualizations but would rather see already pre-selected data highlights from our collection.
If we look at human progress as a graph, it kind of looks like a hockey stick. Everybody was in poverty until about 250 years ago, and then suddenly the line starts going upwards. And now, under industrialization, liberal democracies, people are much richer than they were for most of human history. Is that a good way of putting it?
Absolutely. We are profoundly better off now, and most people lack that historical perspective. If you were to turn on the news, the impression that you would get would not be one of progress. Progress tends to happen on a gradual time scale. It's not sudden and dramatic, and often is not deemed newsworthy. And so most people have a conception of the state of the world that is irrationally pessimistic.
Well, pessimism makes for better news headlines than progress does. And so I'd like to talk about progress, human progress in general, but you've had a couple of series of articles. The most recent one beginning is called Stuff of Progress. But before we get to that, tell me about the heroes of progress. I think you probably had, 24, 25 installments of that?
That's correct. So humanprogress.org is for anyone interested in the improving state of the world, but especially for students and educators. We are an educational website. And the Heroes of Progress series is a really great one for people interested in history, especially students. It highlights individuals who, through their own ingenuity, have improved human well-being on a massive scale. We only highlight people who have either saved or improved millions of lives, not thousands, but millions. And so it's a very selective group of people.
Who are some of the examples of the heroes of progress? I imagine someone like Jonas Salk, who invented the polio vaccine. Who are some of the others?
He was featured. One of the heroes of progress, our first one actually, was Norman Borlaug, and he's probably the person who has saved the most lives of anyone who's ever lived, and yet almost no one has heard of him. He's the father of the Green Revolution, who allowed us to increase our agricultural output to the point where humanity, despite having a world population at an all-time high, has brought hunger to an all-time low.
And Borlaug was working in the, I guess, 1950s and 60s, and in the inventiveness of his agricultural research really started taking root in a literal sense about 1970 or so, and changed the course of agriculture around the world, starting, I guess, in Mexico.
Absolutely. So one individual creating innovations in a field like agriculture or in other fields like medicine that we've highlighted has the ability to make dramatic change for human well-being. And that's what we're trying to highlight with Heroes of Progress. Those individuals who, through their own efforts, whether it was advocating a policy change like giving women the right to vote, or whether it was through an invention that increased agricultural output or that saved lives from a disease, changed or improved, changed positively or saved millions of lives.
Well, we can talk about the heroes of progress for a long time, but I'm really interested in the new series that just began called Stuff of Progress, which I guess refers to things that help humanity grow and survive and thrive.
That's correct. Quite literally, the stuff of progress. This series will focus on the story of the chemical elements and compounds and minerals and materials which have fueled the Industrial Revolution and continue to power the age of abundance that we live in today.
And the first one I noticed was about nitrogen. And, you know, that sounds like something that's in the air around us. But how is nitrogen a stuff of progress, a thing that helps produce progress?
Well, throughout most of human history, the population was very limited by our inability to produce enough food. Even if you go back, you know, much further before Norman Borlaug, we struggled to create enough food. Most people worked in backbreaking agricultural labor, and it was incredibly difficult. We don't have a proper perspective today on just how harsh that life was. But by being able to harness nitrogen from the air in a process that was developed in the early 20th century, we have been able to increase agricultural output dramatically, freeing people from agricultural drudgery.
And when you think about it, 100, 125 years ago, almost half of Americans were engaged in agricultural pursuits. They were farmers or farmhands or ranchers. It's less than 2% of the population now producing more food than ever before. How did that happen?
That's correct. It happens because of an increase in efficiency. We're producing more food than we've ever produced, yet it is, as you say, with less than 2% of the population now in agriculture, freeing the rest of the population for other pursuits and other careers. And one of the sort of fear-mongering things that you hear about technology is this fear that as technology gets rid of jobs, it will cause very negative consequences for society. But what we've actually seen is that turnover in jobs, the destruction, creative destruction of jobs, whether it's in agriculture or in other fields, has actually led to the era of the greatest prosperity that we've ever seen.
And yet there are still people who claim that we're about to enter into some sort of Malthusian nightmare, mm-hmm. where the amount of food can't keep up with the number of people on the planet. But people are a resource too, and that's why starvation has essentially ended in the world, except where governments impose it.
That's correct. Famine is now only still an issue in war zones or places like Venezuela, plagued by other forms of instability due to disastrous policies. Human beings, as you say, are a resource themselves. That was the great insight of the economist Julian Simon, who we're a big fan of at humanprogress.org. We also have a really neat part of the website called the Simon Abundance Index, which examines the relationship between population growth and prosperity. And that's updated every year. And what we found is that actually for every 1% increase in the population, there is almost a 1% decrease in the average cost of commodities. Things become cheaper, more abundant as the population grows, which is counterintuitive. But that's because human beings don't only consume, we also produce. We produce ideas. We find ways to use our resources more efficiently, to find increased supplies of resources, new stores of resources. And we also develop substitutes.
Maybe you could enlighten our listeners about that concept by telling us about the famous bet between Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich. I guess it was in 1980. Can you give me the background on that?
Sure. So Paul Ehrlich was a Stanford University biologist who wrote a best-selling book called The Population Bomb, arguing that in spite of any crash programs embarked upon, now humanity would face starvation within the decade. In the 70s and 80s, he was saying we would have mass starvation. Obviously, we didn't see that. Julian Simon, a University of Maryland economist, as we just discussed, believed that human beings are actually a valuable resource in and of themselves. And so he disagreed with Paul Ehrlich and actually made a bet to put their differing ideas to the test. Paul Ehrlich thought that overpopulation would overwhelm the world's resources and lead to destruction. Julian Simon thought population growth was not a problem because human beings are problem solvers. They decided that they would test this by betting on how the average cost of commodities would change over time. And Julian Simon thought that the price would go down because with population growth, he thought human beings would find ways to make those resources more abundant or develop substitutes, whereas Paul Ehrlich thought that the cost would inevitably go up because a rising population could only lead to greater resource scarcity, which would be reflected in higher prices of commodities. In the end, Julian Simon won that bet, and Paul Ehrlich was forced to write him a check for the difference, the amount that the commodities had declined in price on average.
And yet Paul Ehrlich did not change his mind. He still thinks or thought afterwards that the population growth would lead to civilizational decline. Some people just can't face the facts. Just to sort of wind up here, tell me how you got interested in these ideas. How did you get involved with the ideas of human progress?
So in my case, in graduate school, I read two books that really led me to the ideas of human progress. I read Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined for class, and I read Matt Ridley's The Rational Optimist for pleasure, and those two books really altered my worldview. And then I interned at the Cato Institute for HumanProgress.org, where it turned out that Steven Pinker and Matt Ridley, the authors of those books, were actually on the advisory board, and I was able to help spread these ideas and explore them more in depth. And I was very fortunate to actually attain what is a dream job and be hired on, and now I'm managing editor of the website.
Well, I'll be sure to put links to the website and to those books that you mentioned on our website at bearingdrift.com, and so maybe some of our listeners will be inspired the same way you were. Chelsea Follett, thank you for your time today. I appreciate learning about humanprogress.org, and we'll be looking more into this in the future.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit bearingdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. Mustafa Akyol has previously been a guest on The Score. He returns this week after he published an article in the New York Times about the seemingly intractable conflict between Turkey's government and its minority Kurdish population, a conflict that has expanded to include Kurds in Syria, Iraq, and other countries in the region. Akyol provides some much-needed background information about who the Kurds are and why Turkey feels threatened by them. I spoke to Mustafa Akyol last Wednesday in the library of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. I think what we want to talk about is the aftermath of World War I, when the European powers imposed arbitrary boundaries in what used to be the Ottoman Empire, and this led to all sorts of complications. But one of them was a dispute between the Kurds and the Turks. First of all, who are the Kurds? Most Americans probably have no idea what Kurdistan is or what Kurdish culture is. So who are the Kurds?
Sure. First of all, let me say that there's a great book about the end of World War I titled A Peace to End All Peace. It was declared as a war to end all war. Mm-hmm. But actually what happened was that in the aftermath of World War I, you had these nation states emerging from the Republic of Turkey to Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. Some were colonized and some were independent. But ultimately, those nation states didn't fully fit into the social reality on the ground. And people found themselves on two different sides of the border, although they're one people. Mm-hmm. That especially happened to the Kurds. Now, who are the Kurds? Kurds are one of the Muslim peoples of the Middle East. So just like Turks, Arabs, or Persians, they're Muslim. And in the Ottoman Empire, they used to be one of the many peoples of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, the Ottoman Empire was not an ethnic state. It was a mosaic. And they mostly lived in southeastern Anatolia, northern Iraq, which they still live. So that region was called Kurdistan. It was not a country in itself. It was just a geographic region, but a region where Kurds live. What happened was that the empire crumbled in a very terrible way. I mean, the Armenian genocide is a part of that, and a lot of ethnic cleansing genocide campaigns in the Balkans as well before that. When the empire collapsed, ultimately, states emerged. 27 states emerged from the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, from Tunisia to all the way to Balkans and elsewhere. Kurds found themselves after World War One. Oh, we are divided into four countries now. One is the Republic of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. So they found themselves. They are the biggest stateless people on earth. There are more than. And who knows the exact number, but there are more than 20 million Kurds in the world. Probably almost half of them are in Turkey. Others are in Syria, Iraq, and in Iran. And in all of those countries, you had a problem with the Kurdish population and the central government. The central governments generally suppress them, hoping that they will assimilate them and make them obedient. Quite the contrary, that provoked, reactions from the Kurds. And it is, every country is different, but in Turkey, what happened was that Turkey, for decades and decades, tried what I called assimilationism. Like, Kurds were told, you are actually Turks. You just don't know that. There's a term, mountain Turks. Your accent is a little rough. Your language is actually an offshoot of Turkish, which is totally wrong. You know, if the Kurdish language, if it is something similar, it's similar to the Persian language. But anyway, there was a long process, an effort to assimilate the Kurds, which only provoked reactions and Kurdish rebellions. And in 1984, the biggest Kurdish rebellion began there in 1984. And that was by the PKK. PKK is a Kurdish acronym for Kurdistan Workers' Party. It was a Kurdish nationalist and Marxist-Leninist, movement, an armed group. They started attacking Turkish garrisons, police stations, army battalions, and so on and so forth. At times, they attacked civilian targets. They sometimes killed Kurds who are not on their side, seeing them as traitors. So, my argument is that Turkey has been oppressive, but also PKK is no angel here. So they also have been a violent movement. And that war was inside Turkey for a long time. And actually, U.S. helped Turkey by arresting the head of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, in 1999 when he was on the run in Africa. That's something people forget. He's been in a Turkish jail since then. But in the past several years, the conflict spilled into Syria. Because in Syria, there's a Kurdish party which is the Syrian version of PKK. They swear allegiance to Öcalan, the same leader. They have the same flag. They speak the same language. I mean, in terms of political language. It's called PYD. And they have armed militia called YPG. There are a lot of terms there.
And these are all acronyms or abbreviations in Turkish or Kurdish or not English.
I mean, in Syria, actually, it's Arabic because, they're actually using the common language out there. But ultimately, people's protection units are so ultimately, this is PKK on the other side of the border. And actually, a lot of Turkish Kurds went into Syria to fight with them. And they gained, understandably so, international legitimacy a lot because they fought ISIS. And against ISIS, I would support them too. I mean, ISIS is the worst thing ever. I mean, right? That's the most ferocious evil. And against ISIS, they fought and they got support of the United States. So, and that also made them very, admired. I mean, a lot of people saw guerrillas, women fighting ISIS and defeating them. So, but on the other hand, from a Turkish perspective, okay, ISIS is a terrorist organization, but this is for us a terrorist organization too. I sometimes give the example. Imagine, you know, there was ISIS in Northern Ireland, and IRA became a good fighter against them, and we would all want IRA to win, but the British authorities might still have a concern with this being the IRA. So something like that. And so Turkey has protested this decision by the U.S. to support this group against U.S. didn't mind that much. So I think that was a mistake. I think U.S. should try to bring a grand strategy of convincing Turkey about these people and making these people not belligerent against Turkey. It didn't happen. And Turkey has been boiling with this in the past 4 years. I mean, I'm from Turkey. I know, like, there's anti-Americanism skyrocketed. America is behind the PKK. So that was the perception. And ultimately, President Erdogan found the right time right now to go in, and he convinced President Trump somehow, I think, in a phone conversation. This is at a time when President Erdogan's votes are declining, so he needs a national cause to, you know, maybe that domestic element is there. But also we should understand that, I mean, broader segments of Turkish society are supporting this because Turks are living with the PKK obsession, understandably so, you know, in the past four decades. And the fact that PKK is gaining territory on the other side of the border is something that is alarming to broad segments of Turkish society.
You identified 1984 as the sort of the starting point of the PKK as a nationalist and Marxist-Leninist organization. Was it receiving support from the Soviet Union at that time?
Yes, actually, very much so. Actually, the PKK's origins go back to late 70s, to be precise, but their real big battle began in 1984. They announced it and started attacking targets. Yes, they were getting big support from Syria, actually. Mm-hmm. And Syria was a Soviet ally, of course, at the time. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, gradually they toned down communism a little bit. But still, in their narratives, they had a declaration in 2014 in Turkey. They spoke about establishing village communes. They have a hierarchical system. They're party commissars. So it's still, yes, Marxism is very much there. But that's not the number one thing they're speaking today, especially when they're at an alliance with America. I think they were smart not to, you know, emphasize that part of their ideology. But it is there. And I think it's fair to say that, I mean, compared to ISIS and some other, like al-Nusra, really dangerous jihadists in Syria, they might be preferable. I mean, they're secular and you know, they're socialists, but at least, you know, they will not go after people based on their religion and so on and so forth. However, President Trump was, I think, right about one thing. He said there are no angels today. He said the Kurds are no angels. That's wrong. I'm not saying that. But the PKK, if you refer to the PKK, yeah, PKK is no angel. But I think still, at the end of the day, we need a grand political solution because Turkey can't bomb its way out. Turkey has killed more than 30,000 PKK fighters over the three decades. Turkey kills a fighter, his nephew wants to take revenge. Mm-hmm. Because there's a population behind it. So you can never, I mean, if a terrorist organization is just a few hundred crazy individuals, you can finish that off, right? But if a terrorist organization is rooted in a population with some sympathy, there's no way to finish that. And the more you do that, you just kill destruction. I mean, you cause destruction and death. And also, PKK killed thousands of Turkish soldiers. So this is an endless, Turkey's endless war. And the only end is diplomatic solutions and peace. And I've been a supporter of that in Turkey. But now peace has gone off the rails. But I see no better option than calling it back. It's like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, there was a peace process. It collapsed. And again, you see a confrontation. But still, you have to remind that there's no way out of this. And ultimately, we should come back to the peace table.
We'll get back to our conversation with Mustafa Akyol after this station identification.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
We're talking to Cato Institute Senior Fellow Mustafa Akyol about the conflict between the Turks and the Kurds. Let's pick up where we left off.
Now, the conflict between the PKK and the Turkish government is clear. How do Kurds get along with the other states in which they live, like Iraq? As I recall, after the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, the Kurdish areas of Iraq were the most stable and most well-run. But how did the Kurds get along with other countries in the region?
Yeah. Iraqi Kurds have been so far the most successful in terms of gaining a political, you know, leverage and a territory. One thing is that Iraqi Kurdish movement is not dominated by the PKK. It is being led by the Kurdistan Democratic Party of the Barzani family. And also there's a Talabani family. They are more traditional, let's say right-wing, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. compared to PKK, which is very Marxist and, mm-hmm. you know, quote-unquote progressive, you know, in its narrative. Turkey does not have a problem with Iraqi Kurdistan. I mean, some Turks were in the beginning obsessed with the fact that any Kurdish entity is out there a problem. Mm-hmm. But Erdogan, let's give credit to him for this, the Erdogan government, let's say, said they're not PKK, we don't have a problem with Kurds. So Turkey has actually developed good relations with Iraqi Kurdistan. Turkey built the airport in Erbil, a lot of infrastructure investment. And they have done pretty well until 2017 when they prematurely declared independence. And then Turkey got, you know, threatening, you know, because they were fine on to that point, but they said we don't allow independence. That's because Turkey's obsession is that if there's a still Kurdistan out there, it will influence us. But then the Iraqi government came and crushed that independence movement. So still, though, there's Iraqi Kurdistan constitutionally accepted. Mm-hmm. So it's autonomous. They have their own forces, the Peshmerga, which is Kurdish fighters. And again, Turkey doesn't have a problem with those by definition. Turkey hasn't attacked them or threatened them. In Syria, the Kurdish movement is dominated by PKK, non-PKK or PYD. And the groups against that have been actually sidelined. Some of them escaped to Iraq, by the way. Some Kurdish opposition to mm-hmm. PKK inside Syria had to flee to Iraq. So there is no one element in the world called the Kurds, like mm-hmm. no, the Arabs. It's a bit more complicated than that. And in Iran, there is a Kurdistan region, and it has not an autonomy, but it has some status. There was a Kurdistan declared in Iran, Mahabad's Republic called. It was even independent for a very short while, but Iranians crushed that. I mean, ultimately, this issue will be in the region. Kurds are the biggest stateless people on earth. So some people think that, okay, the problem should be let's create a unified Kurdistan and give all these mm-hmm. territories, right? Now, I normally could sympathize with that if it was a situation like Czechoslovakia, you could break peacefully mm-hmm. into two. But really, it's not that simple because, for example, in Turkey, where the Kurds live in Turkey, the biggest Kurdish city in Turkey is Istanbul. There are more millions of Kurds because they migrated. They live in Western Turkey, which is not, you know, historical Kurdistan.
And so I would guess that the biggest Kurdish city in North America is New York.
Probably, yes. I assume so. And in Turkey, there is not a very clear boundary you can draw as this is Kurdistan. Go to Diyarbakir. There are some Kurdish villages mostly. You'll go you have some Turkish village. Oh, I mean, you go to Malatya, it's divided. So creating a ethnic country in a mixed population like that is a dangerous thing. I mean, this happened with the partition of India.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of that.
Yeah,
as you mentioned.
It was a horrible episode where Muslims and Hindus were divided and millions had to move. Millions were killed in the conflicts. So I'm worried about creating a Kurdistan out of Turkey. My argument is that let's liberalize these countries. Let's decentralize them as well. I'm totally fine with having a Kurdish flag in Diyarbakir under the national flag or something, using Kurdish language everywhere, you know, in the country as a second language. so that the Kurds say, okay, this is our country. You know, because if you go up with the goal of creating an ethnic state for every ethnicity out there, it's like those Russian babies. I mean, when you open, there will be, in that hypothetical Kurdistan, there will be the Zaza. I mean, probably Americans never heard that, but that's a small group within the Kurdish population. Uh-huh. They're saying, we're actually not Kurds, we're Zaza. And the Kurds are saying, no, you are actually Kurdish. So, I mean, there will be minorities within that and so on and so forth.
So the way you describe it, it reminds me of the former Yugoslavia.
Very much so.
Bosnians and Serbs and Croats and Slovenians all lived within the same villages and cities.
Exactly.
Side by side for years until the collapse of the government, and then it got divided into ethnic enclaves.
Exactly. Very much similar. And I certainly want to avoid anything like the end of Yugoslavia scenario. I mean, Yugoslavia was a socialist country, so I don't sympathize with that part. But it was supranational, so mm-hmm. that was... And before that, there was the Ottoman Empire, of course, way before that. And actually, there was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, too, for a while. So if you have these big ethnic... if you have people living under ethnic... I mean, they have their ethnic identities. It's a mixture. It is a good idea to have an overreaching umbrella, like America, right? I mean, American history is different. People came here as migrants, of course. But can you establish in America an ethnic state based on, I mean, there are some crazy people, white, or some other. So, but that's dangerous. America is America. It's a territory of people. So I think we need concepts like that. And that's why I believe I always said, to Kurdish nationals, I said, I don't want an independent Kurdistan. I just want to make Turkey a Kurdistan in the sense that let Kurds be fully at home in Turkey. And for that, let's just get rid of all the Turkish nationalism that is built into and have it a more civic nationalism. I mean, these are the ideas. Of course, I mean, whether people listen to you or not is another thing. But I think that would be the solution I would advocate.
What, just to wrap up, we've gone much longer than I planned on, but I'm pleased. I think we've had a very good conversation here. But what do you think the role of the United States should be in this conflict?
I understand and sympathize with President Trump's idea of not being engaged in endless wars. But pulling out also should be in an orderly way and in a way that doesn't leave a chaos behind. And I think this sudden pullout probably disrupted the balance and Turkey, just rushed into it. I think the U.S. strategy should be, you might need hard power sometimes against groups like ISIS. But other than that, diplomacy is the better way. Regarding the Kurds, what the U.S. can do, and I think what the U.S. should have done 4 years ago when Obama got into the scene, Obama administration, would be to say, okay, against ISIS, we're building a coalition. There are these Kurdish forces in Syria. Ankara, are you concerned about these Kurdish forces? Okay, we will make sure that they declare a principled permanent ceasefire against Turkey. They will not create a problem for you. And in the meantime, we will understand your concerns and you will have to tolerate it. I mean, a better coordination between all the groups that you're working with. What the Obama administration did was basically, okay, we're working with these guys. They're not PKK. You think they're PKK? We don't care about that. And Turkey started to boil with that. I think using diplomacy wisely and while entering into a conflict, understand that you might find some group helpful, but for other people, that might be a problem. Mm-hmm. You might support some group that turn out to be a problem for you in the long run, too. Imagine the Afghan Mujahideen in the 80s, right? I mean, they were fighting the Soviet Union. Of course, that's great. But, some of them later turn out to be Al-Qaeda. So, Americans go to different parts of the world, do things. Just be a bit more careful about the balances that you might be disrupting and some of the unintended consequences you might have in the near future.
Well, we're talking about developments over 100 years. Who knows what will happen in the next 100 years. But Mustafa Akyol, thank you for your time today, and thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
Earlier in the program, We talked to Michael Barone about his new book on American political parties. In this recording from the archives, I asked him about the election of 2012, 7 years ago, and specifically about the race between former Virginia governors Tim Kaine and George Allen for the U.S. Senate. We also touched on Mitt Romney and Bob McDonnell. From the archives in August 2012, here's Michael Barone. I'm here at the Cato Institute with Michael Barone of the American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Examiner. I'd just like to get your take on Virginia's election, so specifically the U.S. Senate race this year.
Well, if you look at the polling for the U.S. Senate race this year, you see that it is a dead even tie between former Governor George Allen and former Governor Tim Kaine. It's about as close as you can get, perhaps even closer than that 6,000 or 7,000 votes by which Jim Webb beat George Allen in 2006.
What do you think explains that closeness?
Half the voters are on one side and half the voters are on the other side. These are both governors who left office with generally positive assessments of their performance as governor. They're each people that have a substantial core constituency, George Allen of conservative Republicans, Tim Kaine of Northern Virginia, which has been trending Democratic, and also in Metro Richmond where he was mayor before he was governor. So, Virginia was the national average in 2008, 53-46 for Obama. It was close to the national average in the House popular vote in 2010. I think Virginia is, going to be very close in this Senate race.
The latest report says that Bob McDonnell has been taken off the short list for Mitt Romney's vice presidential candidate choice. Do you think that's because of the poor performance of the General Assembly this past year?
I don't know whether Bob McDonnell remains on the short list for VP or not. He's an attractive candidate in many ways. He brings with him some a record on cultural issues and an involvement in cultural issues, which the Romney people, Governor Romney, may find problematic in a year when voters are concentrating primarily on economic issues.
Virginia and New Jersey are the only states that have governor's races next year. Are those bellwether states in terms of what the country's looking at?
Well, you can make a case that Virginia and New Jersey have forecast national trends at various times. In 1993, they both voted against Democrats in the governorship, and that proved to be a forecast of the 1994. Similarly, in 2009, go back to 1981, they voted very narrowly for a Republican in New Jersey and for a Democrat in Virginia, and that proved to be kind of a harbinger of 1982. But like all political science rules, this one breaks down if you go far enough back in time or if you live long enough into the future to see it broken.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your comments.
Okay.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to check out previous podcasts on BeringDrift.com for current news, including our preview of the Virginia Film Festival coming up October 23rd to 27th in Charlottesville. There's much more there that you'll like, so visit our website and tell your friends where to find us. Feel free to join the conversation by leaving questions and suggestions in our comments section. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.